Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Nabbing Ned Kelly, the extraordinary true story of the men who brought Australia's notorious outlaw to justice, by David Dufty. Narrated by Grant Cartwright. Publisher's note: this audiobook will refer to visual elements included in the print and ebook editions of the book. They laughed and larked at what they'd done as from the town they turned. They rode away like brigands bold, the Kellys, Hart and Byrne. They chatter now about police, and say they're not effective, but the fear of God is in their hearts of Michael Ward, detective. Corowa Free Press, 13 June, 1879. Introduction. Ned Kelly was tall, strong, good-looking, charismatic, and a formidable hand-to-hand brawler, but he was no hero. A compulsive liar, he was also paranoid and delusional. Ned was good at crime. He was the architect of a large intercolonial criminal syndicate at a time when police were unaccustomed to dealing with organized crime. He stole cattle, horses, guns and gold. He robbed banks. He murdered. And in the end, he was undone by an insane plan to commit an act of mass murder. I'm sure you've heard the legends about him, that he was an Australian Robin Hood, that the murders he committed were in self-defence, that the bank robberies and kidnappings were merely ploys to raise awareness of police injustice, that the common people supported him because he opposed greedy, rich landholders. But none of those things are true, nor are many other things said about him. The original idea for this book was to tell the story of the Kelly Gang from the police point of view. It seemed like an intriguing, exciting, and overlooked angle on a popular topic. The end result, the book you're listening to now, is still broadly in line with that vision, but it has evolved into a wider investigation of myths and lies. That wasn't the plan, but the deeper I dug, the more it became an imperative. There was already so much written and said about Kelly. It was overwhelming. How could one person possibly read it all? There have been dozens of books, as well as songs, plays, poems, documentaries, websites, and movies. But then came the realization. All those books, movies, documentaries, and so on, used the same original source material. So why not start with that? So I initially skipped past all the other books about the Kelly Gang and went right back to basics, studying the original police reports, news coverage, and the proceedings of the 1881 Police Royal Commission. Only after immersing myself in the archival sources and through them forming my own view of events did I explore the work of others. That approach of rebuilding the story from its foundations has led me to question almost everything about the standard historical narrative about the Kelly Gang, and to counter much of what is considered to be fact. The version of events you're about to listen to here is at odds with most versions you're likely to find elsewhere. The Kelly Outbreak, as it was called at the time, was a cataclysmic event. There was saturation news coverage of everything Kelly-related for more than 2 years, from the Stringybark Creek murders in 1878 to sometime after Kelly's execution in November 1880. The news articles retained by the National Library of Australia are a goldmine of contemporary and sometimes primary sources. The public records are a wealth of data too. While many aspects of colonial life were rudimentary, Victoria was ahead of other colonies in record-keeping, and consequently there are thousands of pages of official documents, ranging from detective reports to witness affidavits to internal memos, all in the Victorian Public Record Office. During his reign of terror, Kelly made accusations of police persecution which gained widespread media coverage. In 1881, the Victorian government established a royal commission to investigate the causes of the Kelly outbreak and the police response. The commissioners found no evidence that Kelly or his family were persecuted. Likewise, in searching the various archives 140 years later, I didn't find any evidence of it either. The royal commission cross-examined more than 60 witnesses, and the transcripts of those cross-examinations provide fascinating first-hand accounts of events. Those stories form the backbone of this book, providing a rich cast of characters from every rung of the ladder. At the top is the police commissioner, Captain Standish, a colourful, deeply flawed character with enough redeeming features to make him likeable. Vain and inept senior officers, drunk inspectors, taciturn sergeants and constables who ranged from cowardly to courageous. And in the midst of it all is the Irish-born detective Michael Ward, unjustly portrayed as a minor villain in Kelly mythology, who was Kelly's most dogged and tenacious adversary. When I eventually delved into the subgenre known as Kellyana, I discovered that modern retellings of the Ned Kelly story don't much resemble the narrative that emerges from the archival documents. In some cases, it appears that historians have willfully distorted the historical picture. Most astonishing was my discovery that Ned Kelly himself has been used as a primary historical source. For example, most versions of the Kelly story feature Kelly's stepfather, George King, as his partner in crime for a string of robberies. That's what Ned claimed. Yet there is no mention of George King in any newspaper of the day or in archival records, other than a mention of his marriage to Ned's mother, Ellen, in 1874. The local police had not even heard of him. He seems to have just disappeared, if he existed at all. George King does not feature in this book. In one of his famous Ned Kelly series paintings, Sidney Nolan depicted Constable Fitzpatrick with his arm seductively around Ned's sister Kate, with Ned's figure seen outside through the window. Nolan commented on the historical basis of the artwork, saying, "The action looks a little comic, but it began the real trouble." Since he was an artist rather than a historian, Nolan can be forgiven for believing that falsehood. There are varying accounts of the young policeman's seduction of Kate, but they're all wrong. Not only is there no evidence for it, Ned Kelly himself denied that it happened. Fitzpatrick is a much maligned figure in the fantasy world inhabited by Kelly mythologists. Many claim that when Constable Fitzpatrick came to arrest Ned's brother Dan, he was drunk. There is no evidence for that, other than that he had a single drink earlier in the day, midway on his two-hour journey. It is also said that Fitzpatrick was an alcoholic and that he died of cirrhosis of the liver. But he wasn't, and he didn't. Ned Kelly claimed that he murdered three police at Stringybark Creek in self-defense, but the forensic evidence and the testimony of the only police survivor of the massacre comprehensively refuted that version of events. Yet Ned's version is routinely treated as historical fact. It is said that the courts had it in for him, yet the opposite was true. Browsing court reports in old newspapers, I discovered that district magistrates, either through corruption or fear, went easy on crime, using any paltry excuse to acquit. Prosecutors struggled to produce witnesses, who failed to appear or changed their testimony on the stand, or simply vanished before they had a chance to testify. There are plenty more myths. Many arise either from strange and unreliable source material, such as interviews with the children or grandchildren of people who were there, or second- or third-hand memoirs that amount to nothing more than rumour and hearsay. Others arise from cherry-picked or misinterpreted quotes from the proceedings of the Royal Commission. It's appalling. I am not the first to discover the hollow heart of the Ned Kelly myth. Others have challenged the lies, but their voices have been drowned beneath the chorus of adulation for a manipulative, violent psychopath. But this is not Ned Kelly's story. This is the story of the men who tried to bring him to justice. The Days of Harry Power. 1. Magistrate McBean's Heirloom Watch. Robert McBean was a squatter and magistrate from northeastern Victoria. He owned Kilfra, a large sheep station, called a run, near the township of Benalla. He was doing reasonably well, although Kilfra's soil wasn't as fertile as that of nearby runs. He had also lost some of his land, which had been sold off by the government in small parcels known as selections, under recent land reform laws. While patrolling his property on horseback on a pleasant afternoon in March 1870, he noticed two horsemen. The older of the two, a bushranger known as Harry Power, approached McBean. The younger man held back and turned away, as if concerned that McBean would recognize him, and indeed, McBean believed he did recognize him as Ned Kelly, a young man he had seen in court a time or two. Harry Power ordered McBean to dismount. When McBean refused, Power drew a revolver, pointed it at him, and asked a second time. McBean dismounted. Power wanted cash, but McBean had none. After all, he was just riding around his own property. However, he was carrying a watch. That would do. Power told him to tie the watch to the horse's bridle. Then, after he did so, Power led the horse away. The gold watch was a cherished family heirloom and worth more than the horse. McBean was particularly aggrieved by the robbery because he believed that as a magistrate, he had cultivated a tacit understanding with the local criminals through leniency and generosity. The judiciary would go easy on well-connected, organized criminals and in turn would either get a quiet bonus or would not be targeted for crime. Their stock would not be stolen, nor would their haystacks catch fire overnight. Harry Power, whose real name was Henry Johnson, had escaped from Pentridge Prison a year earlier in February 1869. He had been serving time with hard labour for shooting a policeman and horse theft. He was also suspected of two murders, never proven. One day, while working in the prison labour gang, he lay down in a grassy hollow and waited for nightfall. When the guards escorted the other prisoners back inside the prison walls, he fled. By the time they realized he was gone, it was too late. He had scars on his right cheek, forehead, and arms, and the third finger on his left hand was deformed. His feet were so diseased with bunions that he had trouble walking and needed oversized boots. Despite being easily recognized and hobbled by disease, he wasn't caught. Power headed to northeastern Victoria, to the hills and mining towns of the Ovens and Murray River catchments, where he took refuge with old mates and resumed his life of crime. Over the next year, he robbed rich and poor alike, appearing with his shotgun and shouting the infamous bushranging cry, "Bail up!" He bailed up stagecoaches, farmhouses, liquor stores, lonely travellers, and itinerant workers. He set fire to a store in Gundagai, savagely beat a Chinese miner who refused to obey him, and stole a little boy's comforter at gunpoint. He boasted that he loved targeting farmhouses after the husband had gone to work and the wife was home alone. He crisscrossed the colony, sometimes committing robberies more than 100 miles distant in the space of a day. There were reports that he had a young accomplice, who was initially known only by the name Lake. The identity of his accomplice had now been established by McBean as Ned Kelly, a lad who lived with his mother and several siblings on a small property near Greta, east of Benalla. Some months before he was robbed, McBean had gone to court after two of his employees had stolen and killed two of his sheep. There, he had encountered Ned Kelly. One of the thieves, Alex Gunn, was Ned Kelly's brother-in-law. The teenaged Kelly appeared as a witness for the defence, claiming he had sold Gunn the sheep. When asked what brands the sheep had, Kelly said there were no brands. Keeping a straight face, he explained it was because they were pets. Gunn was issued with a £10 fine, a slap on the wrist for a crime that attracted serious prison time. Edward Kelly, better known as Ned Kelly, was probably born in June 1855 in the colony of Victoria. His parents were both Irish. His father, John Red Kelly, had been transported to a prison in Van Diemen's Land as a convict, gained freedom, and tried to make a new life in Victoria. But he was a heavy drinker and died of alcohol-related illness when Ned was still a boy. Ned's mother Ellen had come to Victoria in 1841 as a child with her parents and many siblings, as free settlers. Her father, James Quinn Sr., was a hard worker and a prudent saver who had hoped his children would have a better life in Victoria than the impoverished existence they had left behind in Ireland. But it turned out that Ellen's brothers cared only for drinking and stealing cattle. It was generally said that James was an honest man, although the land he purchased, the Glenmore Run, was on the stock smuggling route through the King Valley. After Red died, Ellen had other lovers and more children. Ned fell under the influence of his criminal uncles, then took up bushranging with the notorious Harry Power. Meanwhile, a plan to end Power and Kelly's crime spree was born over drinks at an exclusive club in Melbourne. 2. The Melbourne Club. The Melbourne Club on Collins Street looks much the same today as it did in 1870. The lampposts at the entry, the three-story brick and stucco walls, the bay windows, the basement windows below street level that peer onto the mossy servants' alley. Inside, there is still a labyrinth of hallways, entryways, bedrooms, sitting rooms, and dining rooms. Of course, there aren't stables anymore. Those are long gone, along with the servants living in the basement. But it's largely unchanged from a century and a half ago. And furthermore, it's still an exclusive men's club, restricted to men of status and wealth in Melbourne society. It was founded in 1838 by a group of 23 gentlemen, most of whom were wealthy farmers who wanted the club to provide a comfortable place for them to stay when visiting Melbourne. The membership soon expanded to include lawyers, bureaucrats, military officers, merchants, and other respectable professions. Nobody pays attention to the Melbourne Club these days. It's a historical curiosity, a quiet feature of the city that somehow resisted the sweep of progress. It has no influence and, for the most part, attracts little ire. Not like then. Not like the days when a new governor's first social engagement, after stepping ashore from England, would be to dine as guest of honour at the club, when most parliamentarians were club members, or when a Victorian premier attacked the clique or cabal who aspire through the Melbourne Club to rule the colony. But even then, its political power was exaggerated. Its membership included politicians of all political stripes, not just reactionaries, and even included that bane of squatters, Premier James McCulloch. And the club, perhaps sensitive to such criticisms, went to lengths to quash any hint of political activity behind its austere walls. Activism, including the circulating of petitions, was forbidden. Private discussions over a cigar and brandy were acceptable. Which brings us to March 1870, to a private conversation over brandy between two club members. One of them was Robert McBean. The other was Captain Frederick Standish, the Chief Commissioner of Police. McBean was telling Standish about his recent experience on his farm. In their conversation, McBean complained bitterly that Harry Power had been terrorising the northeastern towns near the Ovens River for more than a year, and the police had done nothing. Why? Well, he and Standish both knew the answer to that. The police force was a shambles. Frederick Standish had been born into a wealthy upper-class English family, had mixed with royalty, and had held the rank of captain in the British Army. But he was a man of pleasure, and amassed such a colossal gambling debt that he had fled Britain for Victoria under the pseudonym F.C. Selwyn, without a penny to his name. He became a miner in Ballarat in 1852, experiencing firsthand the tyranny of the Goldfields police and bureaucrats prior to the Eureka Rebellion. Eventually, desperate for income, he dropped the pseudonym and entered the public service. He ascended quickly. The following year, he was appointed to the role of Chinese Protector, a position created in response to ethnic tensions on the goldfields. Standish took to it with gusto, using his position to champion the interests of the Chinese community. On one occasion, an interracial couple, a Chinese man and a Caucasian woman, came to him for help, complaining that the local clergy had refused to conduct their wedding. Standish conducted the ceremony himself, pronounced them man and wife, then forged the name of the town's Anglican priest on the registration document. In 1858, he was appointed as Chief Commissioner of Police and became responsible for reforming a dysfunctional service. In the earliest days of the colony, police had been recruited primarily from ex-convicts, and although that hiring practice had now ceased, many were still either former convicts or former convict guards. There had been no entry requirements until 1853, not even the ability to read and write, and no training. Alcoholism was rampant. The force had come under public and political scrutiny after the Eureka Rebellion on the Ballarat goldfield. A reformer, Standish managed the evolution of the force into a functional, respectable institution. But old habits returned. With his generous salary, he resumed gambling and drinking. His parties and all-night card games were legendary. Standish's love of pleasure was his greatest weakness and led to his greatest failing as chief commissioner. He was fond of his drinking and gambling friends, and officers who aspired to higher ranks discovered an easy pathway to promotion. Standish played favourites, and in this, his judgment was clouded. He had only partial control over promotions, which were ultimately decided by the politicians, but to the extent that he did not always choose well. The Melbourne Club became a second home to him. And indeed, in 1872, 2 years after the conversation with McBean, he moved in permanently, conducting the business of running the Victorian police force from its cloistered private rooms. As the evening wore on at the Melbourne Club, a waiter dressed in blue and red livery, with gilt buttons, kept up the flow of drinks, while McBean and Standish talked over the Harry Power problem. Power must be getting local assistance, and McBean had an idea how he might discover who had been helping him. Power had served time in Pentridge with a local thief named Jack Lloyd, who had since been released. The Lloyd family were notorious criminals, and Jack Lloyd himself was married to a Quinn, which made him Ned Kelly's uncle. Lloyd probably knew who was harbouring Power. Standish proposed that Jack Lloyd could be recruited as a fizz gig, a paid informer who would share in the reward then being offered for information leading to Harry Power's capture. He proposed a plan to McBean, one that bypassed the incompetent local police. McBean was sceptical, but he really wanted his watch back. 3. The Fizz Gig. Under Standish's instructions, a warrant was issued for Jack Lloyd's arrest, and he was arrested on the 9th of April 1870 by two Melbourne detectives. The warrant was bogus. They arrested him for an armed hold-up near Seymour that they knew had been committed by Power. The local police were cut completely out of the loop. The next day, he was transported to Seymour Lockup, awaiting a hearing. He was a captive audience for Robert McBean's proposal. McBean told Lloyd about his watch, stolen by Power, and said he wanted it back. If Lloyd was willing, he could meet McBean at Kilfarrer Station for further discussions. It seems he was willing, because when he appeared in Seymour Court, all charges were either dropped or dismissed. The second part of Standish's plan was to increase the reward money for the capture of Power, to make it worth Lloyd's while. Standish made the case to the Chief Secretary, who increased the reward to £500. In early May, Standish visited the police depot at the Melbourne suburb of Richmond, where he had a quiet chat with Superintendent Frank Hare. He explained the setup he had arranged with McBean and Lloyd to catch Harry Power, and asked, or rather ordered, Hare to run the operation. The Chief Secretary, James McCulloch, had directed him to place Frank Hare in charge. As Lloyd's visit to Kilfarrer Station was imminent, Standish told Hare to get on his way as soon as possible. He promised him that if he succeeded, he would be promoted at the next opportunity. Before parting, he gave Hare complete latitude. "I leave you to make your own arrangements and take with you whoever you please." Frank Hare was a large, tough man. He had been born in South Africa in 1830, the youngest of 20 children. He arrived in Victoria to join the gold rush in 1852. He went from Ballarat to Beechworth and then to Bright, striking luck occasionally, but mostly striking dirt. He lived rough and poor and had several run-ins with the police before throwing in his shovel and moving to Sydney, where he struggled to find work. A well-connected relative, a distant cousin named Colonel Butterworth, who was the governor of Singapore, looked him up when visiting Sydney. Butterworth pitied his sad, down-at-heel relative, so he pulled some strings and got Hare a job as a constable in the Victorian police. That was the extent of Hare's connections. He knew someone who knew someone who knew Captain Standish. He would never be a member of the Melbourne Club, enjoying port and cigars with Standish and his circle of judges and politicians. But it was enough to get a start. His experience on the goldfields helped. Whenever gold was found in a creek or river, there was a new rush. A city would grow and spread across river plains and mountain valleys like weeds, with winding mazes of tents, makeshift huts, and mine shafts. The muddy roads, carved by boots and wagon wheels, were lined with hawker carts, makeshift theatres, and grog shops. Women mostly avoided these places, but male fortune seekers, scoundrels, and dreamers flocked to them. Theft, assault, and murder were common. Riots sometimes broke out. The police were often simply engaged in crowd control. A big, burly police officer like Hare, who had been a miner himself, was ideally suited for the job. At 40, he was putting on weight and slowing down, but was still fit and strong enough for a bushranger hunt. As Hare prepared his horse and buggy, Superintendent Charles Nicholson came to Richmond Depot. He told Hare that he knew about the mission and asked if he could come along. Head of the police district at Kyneton in the Macedon Ranges, Nicholson was currently in Melbourne on extended sick leave due to migraines and inflamed eyes. Nicholson was Scottish, 41 years old, and had come to Victoria in 1852, the same year as Hare. But he had joined the police force a year earlier than Hare, which technically made him the senior officer of the two, a fact he liked to mention. Nicholson would have been right at home in the Melbourne Club with Captain Standish, but he was not a brandy and cigar type. His wife, Helen, was the daughter of John Thomas Smith, a long-serving prominent member of Parliament and also one of Victoria's highest-ranking Freemasons. Nicholson's life was comfortable from start to finish. He had never lived in desperate poverty as Frank Hare, or Captain Standish for that matter, had done. But many years earlier, as a young policeman, he had been responsible for a stunning act of bravery. In his first year as a police cadet, he had been engaged with a small party of police in a search for some bushrangers and had come under fire. Nicholson tore up his own shirt to make a tourniquet for a colleague's wound, saving his life. Then he and his superior galloped off in pursuit and engaged the bushrangers in another gunfight. Nicholson was shot in the face. The wound left a permanent scar and gave him migraines for the rest of his life. Nicholson had an excellent work ethic, but a dour and condescending manner, perhaps exacerbated by chronic pain. He was also a snob. Standish referred to him behind his back as the cranky Scotchman. Around the 10th of May, they rode together in Hare's horse and buggy to Kilfra, where Robert McBean was expecting them. Jack Lloyd arrived. Hare spoke to Lloyd in private, then returned to tell the others the deal was off. Hare didn't trust Lloyd, and Lloyd didn't trust Hare. Nervously, McBean said, "If that be the case, what risk do I run now, having trusted and arranged with this man to take the reward?" It showed the power of the local criminal gangs that a police magistrate was worried about being a police snitch. Nicholson offered to try to win Lloyd over. He and Lloyd moved away and spoke privately. Then, when they returned, Nicholson announced that the deal was back on, with the proviso that Lloyd received all the reward money. Nicholson wrote him a memo promising him the entire £500 if he helped to catch power. The four arranged to meet again once Lloyd had made some inquiries. Only days earlier, the local police had received a tip-off that Harry Power and Ned Kelly were at Kelly's mother's shanty, having ridden overnight after committing a distant robbery. At daybreak, on the 4th of May, four police surrounded the Kelly shanty and moved in. They were led by District Superintendent Nicholas and also included Sergeant James Whelan, Constable Mullane, and Constable Arthur. Harry Power was gone, but Ned was home, so they brought him in. A crowd gathered in Benalla to see the arrested bushranger. Kelly was in a cheerful mood, smiling and nodding at familiar faces as he was taken to the Benalla lockup. The township of Benalla was quite close to McBean's Kilfra run, around 10 miles further west. Nicholson and Hare decided to take advantage of this development. They visited young Kelly in the Benalla lockup.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?